Good morning. I wanted to do something a little different this morning and perhaps use these ideas as a running theme, maybe from time to time, that I might do on Sunday mornings, but we'll see about that. What I want to do this morning is look at, as you can see here, archaeology in the Bible. And really what I mean by that are, what are the reasons from archaeology that we can trust in the Bible? And as Christians, one of the things that we strive to do every week, every day, is to align our lives more and more with this book. None of us do this perfectly, but if someone was to ask you what good reasons you have for trying to base your whole life off of this, what would be some of the things that you'd be able to say about that? Now, I have a couple reasons for wanting to do this lesson. One reason for this would be that you might have non-Christian friends that are at a point where maybe they want Christianity to be true, and so because of that, they're more open to objective reasons to believe in the Bible. And so these things might be helpful to share from time to time. But maybe another reason for doing this is because sometimes you have questions and doubts and struggles that maybe you're afraid that if you were to ask those questions, you would be scolded and scoffed at or something like that. And so maybe something like this would be helpful for all of us in from different perspectives. But let me just explain. There's a couple of reasons, several different reasons why people might not believe in the Bible. They might not base their life off of what the scriptures say. And you could categorize these three. There's my Minnesota coming out. You can categorize these three different reasons. The first one being emotional reasons. That there are certain things that the Bible teaches, or there are certain realities in this world, like why does God allow evil and suffering? That's an emotional kind of objection to belief in God. You could ask the question, why are Christians sometimes hypocritical? Now, that's an easy question to answer intellectually. But for some people, emotionally, that kind of grips them and makes them have a bad taste in their mouth about religion and Christianity. So there's emotional reasons people may not believe. There's volitional reasons. This is when there are things that the Bible tells you to do that you don't feel like doing. And there are things that the Bible tells you to stop doing that you really enjoy doing. And so you might get involved in all of these intellectual kind of sounding arguments and all of this kind of stuff. But really what's underneath it is there are certain things that I don't want to give up and there are certain things that I want to do. We'll say more about that tonight when I look at the book of Jude. But that's the second reason, is volitional reasons. And then thirdly, there are people that have honest, sincere intellectual struggles, where they see the beauty of Christianity, they would like it to be true, but they want some intellectual ideas to sink their teeth into, so that whenever they have moments of emotional doubt or volitional doubt and things like that, that I can always go back to these intellectual things that kind of become anchors for me in my belief. So this morning we're going to look at some intellectual things that show that the Bible, I think, is reliable, it's true, it gives us, we have a lot of good reasons to trust in it. And so we're going to do that with this idea of archaeology. Now, before we get into a couple examples of this, I want to say a couple things to get into this discussion a little bit more. There's a lot of people in the world today that would say that the Bible is just like Homer's Odyssey. It's just like the ancient writings of that different religious people have devoted themselves to some extent, or were trying to explain different events from mythological kind of perspectives with some of these miracles that are recorded and stuff like this. There's a lot of people that approach the Bible that way, that there's really no difference between what we read in the scriptures as opposed to some of the things from some of those other writings. And it seems like Peter in the New Testament was aware of that. You remember that time when Peter was on the Mount of Transfiguration? And Jesus, who just climbed up a mountain, would have maybe had his clothes sweat stained after climbing up a big mountain. And then even in that setting, his clothes and everything change into being radiant white. And later, Jesus, when they're coming down the mountain, Jesus tells the apostles, don't tell anybody about this until after I've resurrected. Did Peter ever tell anybody about that moment? Remember in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, for we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. You think Peter's aware that perhaps in this time period, people were trying to equate the things that the Bible says with fairy tales, with myths? And then he's saying to this audience, well after the resurrection of Jesus, that we were eyewitnesses of things like His majesty when He transformed. That this is not made up stuff that we had in just some kind of vision. We saw this stuff with our own eyes. And added to that, Jesus is somebody that wants us to look at proof. Jesus was somebody that He didn't just say, come on, guys, I'm the Son of God. Just believe me. You remember before Jesus ascended in the book of Acts, it says in Acts chapter 1, verse 3, He presented Himself alive to them after His suffering by many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days. After 3.5 years with the disciples, here's Jesus appearing with them for 40 more days, giving them more proof that He really did rise from the dead. He's eating fish in front of them. He's inviting Thomas to touch the nail-scarred hands, touch the side, everything like that. He's letting them have more and more proof. By the way, remember when Jesus, before He started His public ministry, He had 40 days of being tempted in the wilderness and then He goes out? That's kind of His preparation time in some ways. For the apostles in the book of Acts, they have 40 days with Jesus and He's giving them evidence after evidence. And then He says, okay, now go out with your bold and faith now that it's intellectually anchored by these things that I just showed you. So if the Bible allows us to look at evidences, one of the evidences that I think that we can look at are things like archaeology. There's actually so many things that have been found in archaeology that confirmed the Bible, or the Bible said such and such event happened, and then there was doubters and skeptics that didn't really happen because there's no evidence for these things, and then eventually some kind of discovery showed that it really did happen. That happens so many times now that there's certain parts of the Middle East and in Turkey where biblical archaeologists can't look anymore because they keep uncovering more and more evidences. So we're going to look at some examples of this. Before we look at just a couple, though, I want to say one more thing. Sometimes I believe Christians that are really well-meaning can try to bring up certain archaeology to prove the Bible, but it's not very based on very good evidences. For example, Noah's Ark. Have you ever seen those aerial pictures of what's supposed to be Noah's Ark on the mountains of Ararat? And you can't really tell just based on the shape that people think that maybe it is, but maybe it's not. There's not enough good evidence for that. Or the chariot wheels in the Red Sea. Have you ever seen that one? The pictures online. Look for the swords or something. That seems to be more coral reef than anything. I don't think that those are chariot wheels. Or the Shroud of Turin. Have you heard of the Shroud of Turin? The thing that Jesus was allegedly buried in. And the shroud has had a very interesting backstory to it. But some people try to use this as evidence that Jesus really was buried. But if you look at the backstory of the shroud, it's been in so many different places. There's certain things that don't have enough evidence that wouldn't be good or convincing to bring up to somebody. So the ones that I want to bring up are the ones that at least I think are convincing. So we'll look at a couple examples from the Old Testament, and then we'll look at a couple examples from the New Testament. The first one being the discovery of the Hittites. The Hittite people in the Bible, they span from the time of Abraham. Genesis chapter 15 brings up the Hittites, and they go all the way to the reign of Solomon. So they have a big span of time in the Bible, and they're named 60 times. They're part of the conquest of the Israelites. So they have a really important place in Old Testament history. But one of the things that a lot of scholars and skeptics had said, David's mighty man Uriah the Hittite was the most famous Hittite, by the way, that there's a lot of skeptics that were saying that nobody has really found any archaeological evidence for the Hittites. And so because they're such an important part of the Old Testament story and some of the roles that they play, that there's no good reason to really believe in the stories of David. There's no good reasons to believe in Genesis to 1 Kings, because that's the time period that they span. And so it seems like the Bible is indeed a fairy tale. Until 1906, the capital of the Hittite place was discovered. There's an archaeologist named Hugo Winkler. And this is a picture of what they found in Turkey. And in this place, it's called Bogaz Koy, which I guess that's the capital of the Hittites. They found in this place 10,000 clay tablets. And in these 10,000 clay tablets, they found that where the capital was, they found alliances and treaty documents with other nations and stuff like this. Some people have said that this is one of the greatest archaeological discoveries ever. we've lived over 100 years after this, but before 1906, what did the secular, sophisticated scholars write about? That the Bible's a fairy tale because we don't have any evidence of the Hittites, and then this was discovered, and then those arguments went away. So that's the first example here. Here's another one. Proof of King David. King David is an interesting guy, named 1,081 times in the Bible. He's in 62 chapters of the Bible, and then he writes a lot of the Psalms as well. And he seems to follow kind of like this hero archetype thing that people talk about, where he rose to power, he was from this obscure place, became very important, he defeated Goliath, he did all of these really interesting things, but there's no archaeological evidence for him. So it seems, again, like the Bible's a fairy tale, at least the story with David is, and David really matters, because remember the promises that God made to David? That through his lineage, there would be a king that would reign on the throne forever. There's one scholar who at one point said that David is no more historical than King Arthur. This was a more recent one, but in 1993, there was an obelisk that was found. And here's a picture of an obelisk. Back then, they didn't have all the nice paper to write on and stuff like that. They would write on a lot of these kind of monument, these stone sorts of things. So there's this obelisk that was found, and on this obelisk, it talks about when Hazael, king of Syria, defeated Joram and Ahaziah in the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 28 and 29 says, I slew mighty kings who harnessed thousands of chariots and... this is what the obelisk says. I slew many mighty kings who harnessed thousands of chariots and thousands of horsemen. I killed the king of the house of David. Now, this is written well after the time of David, but it's saying that I killed this king. He killed somebody that's in the lineage of the house of David. And in 1993, this was enough evidence for the scholars who doubted the existence of David to say, well, he must have actually existed. So that's why in modern scholarship, you don't have people doubting his existence anymore because of this thing. And then there's other things that have been found as well. But that was a game changer for a lot of people in the archaeological world. Notice a third example from the Old Testament. The Assyrian besiegement of Jerusalem. There's a story that takes place in 2 Kings 18 and 19. And the Assyrians had recently besieged the northern kingdom and taken them away into exile. And after they had taken them away into exile, they go down to the southern kingdom. And they start to besiege the nation. And 2 Kings talks about this event in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 13. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Can you imagine living in Jerusalem? You're in this high city, and all the surrounding kind of suburban areas in this capital area have just been decimated and destroyed. And perhaps from the mountain of Jerusalem, you can see the flames and the fire all around as you look out. And as this is happening, we'll see what just happens in a second. God ends up delivering the Assyrians. But there's something called the Taylor Prism that was found in 1830. And here's a picture of it. When I was in Santee, California, there was a biblical museum sort of thing. And they had a replica of this thing, the Taylor Prism. And on this Taylor Prism, it records what the king of Assyria did to the southern kingdom. And it says, for example, that Sennacherib besieged and captured 46 of his, that's Judah's, fortified cities, along with many smaller towns taken in battle with my battering rams. I took as plunder 200,150 people, both small and great, male and female. Notice that the biblical record in 2 Kings 18 says that they come up, they're taking all these places, and then this Taylor Prism says exactly the same kind of thing. The prism goes on to say this in another part of it. As for Hezekiah, I shut him up like a caged bird in his royal city of Jerusalem. I then constructed a series of fortresses around him, and I did not allow anyone to come out of the city gates. All right, so the city is completely surrounded. Isaiah, who was a prophet that wrote things prior to this actual moment, says that this is what's going to happen in Isaiah chapter 8, verses 7 and 8, where it says, "Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria in all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck." What's the picture that Isaiah is giving? Can you imagine him going to King Hezekiah and he says, "Hey, you know those people that are destroying all the suburban areas? They're going to get closer and closer to the capital. And it's going to be like you're being drowned, that the water's going to get so high that it's going to get up to your neck and you're going to try to keep your nose above water. That's what's going to happen." And then, I don't know how long afterwards, those things happened. And then even Sennacherib writes about these kinds of things. All right, those are just some examples from the Old Testament. There's a lot of examples from the Old Testament, but I want to shift to a couple from the New Testament. The first one in the New Testament being the accuracy of the book of Acts. This is an interesting thing that somebody named Sir William Ramsay engaged in a lengthy experiment with, I guess. But from 1880 to 1890, that was a period of scholarship, especially, where people started to really doubt the historical reliability of the book of Acts. And if you go back to some of the scholarship from those years, you'll see people hammering against the book of Acts for a lot of different kinds of reasons that they thought were very valid at the time. But there was an archaeologist kind of guy, scholar, I think he was kind of both, named Sir William Ramsay. And what he did is he said, "All right, I think that the travel routes that Paul did in the book of Acts are ridiculous. They don't make a lot of sense." So what he started doing is he started copying the same travel routes that the book of Acts records. And he found that the travel routes actually make total sense, that geographically the book of Acts is accurate, that Paul would go up or this or north or east, like all the directions are exactly right. So that he said, Sir William Ramsay said this, "You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment, provided always that the critic knows the subject and does not go beyond the limits of science and justice." All right. So after he engaged in this experiment, that scholarship that denied Acts started to diminish quite a bit. But let's ramp this up a little bit with what Sir William Ramsay is saying here. Think about some of the statistics that you find in the book of Acts. In Acts, you have 32 countries named. You have 54 cities. You have 9 Mediterranean islands mentioned in the book of Acts. It also names 95 people. Some of these are political rulers and all of this, these different kinds of things. And wherever archaeology has been able to confirm these things, none of it has ever contradicted. The city, the countries, the cities, all of these places we know are real places. The people that have been named in the book of Acts, archaeology has confirmed so many of those people and the political position that they had. So here's a question to consider with the book of Acts. If Acts is correct on the secular history, why would we suddenly say that it was wrong about the miracles? That's not the kind of thing that you see in Homer's Odyssey, for example, or other ancient writings that talk about miraculous events. They're wrong kind of about everything. Some of it is somewhat rooted in some historical places, but you can identify where they're wrong in places as well. With Acts, it's right on all the secular things. Wouldn't it be consistent to say, well, it seems maybe reasonable that they would be right about the other things as well? So that's something from the book of Acts. Next thing from the New Testament is the existence of Pilate. Pontius Pilate, obviously very important. He was the guy that could give the green light to the execution of Jesus. And he's named 59 times in the New Testament. But there's a lot of people that said that, he's a Roman official. There's no historical writings about this guy. There's no archaeological evidence. And so people would question the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus because the guy that apparently gave the green light to it has never been discovered archaeologically. And so it seems like that's made up as well. But in 1961, there was an Italian archaeological team that discovered something that's called the Pilate inscription. And this is a picture of it. And on this slab, I'll explain what it is in just a second. But on this slab, it says this. Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, made and dedicated the Tiberium to the emperor, to the divine emperor. Notice here that that Pilate is called the prefect. Another word for that is governor. Look how this matches with Luke chapter 3, verse 1. In Luke chapter 3, verse 1, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea. All right, so whenever this slab was found, people said, okay, well, it seems like Pontius Pilate was real. So after 1961, 62, that scholarship that denied the existence of Pilate, that started to diminish as well. What is this thing, though, this Tiberium structured slab thing? It seems like what this is something that's dedicated to the divine emperor. In the ancient world, there would be, in the Roman world, there would be different cult worship centers for the emperor. And so this seems like a slab that was set up in front of it so that people knew what it was, who it was for, who put it together, all of that kind of thing. By the way, if you had centers like that all over the Roman Empire, can you imagine why the Christians were being persecuted so heavily? Because when they would walk around and they would say, it's actually Jesus who's the king, it's not that guy, and there's people going to that structure right now where slabs like this are right in front of them, he's not really the king. Jesus is the true king. You see why the Romans went after them so heavily? They thought it was such a subversive message. All right, so that's the existence of Pilate. Last one is my favorite one. Crucifixion and proper burial. It used to be the case that when it came to Jesus's crucifixion, that skeptics used to say a couple things that the Bible records wrongly. The first one being was that Jesus was not actually nailed to a cross, because we know, or we thought we did, that people were tied with ropes to the cross. That's what people used to think. That nails eventually were used, but it was not used in the time of Jesus. So when Jesus was crucified, they would have used ropes, not nails. So when Jesus invites Thomas, look at the scars in my hands and stuff like that, the Bible gives proof that he was nailed to it. They said that that was inaccurate. They also would say this, that Jesus couldn't have been buried. Well, the reason that they would say that is because when people were crucified as criminals, that they were their bodies were thrown into the valley of Hinnom or Gehenna. That's the image that Jesus starts to use for hell. That's where the bodies would go, and then the vultures would eat the bodies and all this kind of thing. And so if Jesus was crucified, he certainly wouldn't have been given a proper burial. So when it talks about Joseph of Arimathea doing the things that he did to bury Jesus, those kinds of things would never have happened. But in 1968, there was an archaeologist named Vasilio Zafaris, and he found something called an ossuary box. Anybody know what this is? This ossuary box. 2.5 feet wide. What these boxes were for was to keep the bones of people that had been buried. So people would be put into a tomb, and their bodies would be in the tomb for a year while their skin and their organs would decompose. And then they would put the bones into an ossuary box, and that's where it would be stored. And so if you found bones in an ossuary box, that meant that that person had been given a proper burial. Otherwise, you would never have an ossuary box because the bones would have been scattered into the Valley of Hinnom. And so in this ossuary box, what they found was a heel bone with a nail in it. Here's a picture of it. So here's somebody that was given a proper burial because the bones are in the ossuary box, and in the heel bone, there's a nail sticking through it. What would the nail have been used for? To crucify somebody. So here's clear evidence that it was possible to be somebody that was crucified and also given a proper burial. This one discovery in 1968 caused people to stop saying that Jesus had to have been tied by a rope. Scholarship before that said that. And also that Jesus couldn't have been given a proper burial, because here's a clear-cut proof that that did happen at times. There's, by the way, olive wood, like, intermingled with this nail, showing that the wood that he would have been nailed to would have been an olive wood cross or something like that. And so that one discovery shows that. Now, I don't know if you've heard people today say, well, there's no archaeological evidence for the Exodus, or there's no archaeological evidence for Elijah and Elisha. There's no archaeological evidence for this king of the northern or the southern kingdom. And the people will go on and on and with all these different things that we don't have. This has been happening for years, where people will say, we don't have this, and then eventually it's discovered, but we have enough things that have been discovered that, what if we never find Noah's Ark? Doesn't bother me. What if Noah built a house out of the thing? He probably needed the wood. What if we don't find archaeological evidence for this event or that event? We have enough. God has given us so much. One thing that I know that archaeologists will never find is the ossuary box of Jesus, though. You want to make an argument from silence? We know where Buddha was buried. We know where Muhammad is buried. Do you know what archaeologists will never find? Is Jesus's bones, because he was resurrected and he's at the right hand of the Father now. As we look at these things, I hope we can be more and more confirmed in our belief and our conviction that the Word of God will remain forever. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 8, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the Word of our God will stand forever. Do we have good reasons for trusting in the Bible and basing our lives off of it? We do. This is just a small, small, small sampling of the kinds of evidences that God has given us, and I think invites us to look at. If you're here this morning and you've been struggling in your faith, or you've got some other kind of concern that this lesson hasn't really been designed to address this morning, there are people here that would like to address the struggles that you have. If there's anybody here that has a need, there's people here that will talk to you. We've got an eldership that will sit down with you and talk about the struggles that you have. But this is an opportunity for us to think about our faith, to think about how committed we are to the things that Jesus has done for us. If there's anything that we can do or assist you with this morning, we're about to sing the song, Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb? If that's not true for you, consider your soul and where you're going to go when you die. If there's anything we can do for you, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.